I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Tony Fidel, co-founder of Nest Labs, a company that makes smart digital assistants for the home. Their first project, the Nest Learning Thermostat, launched to consumers in fall of 2011. Prior to founding Nest, Tony spent 9 years at Apple. He was the senior vice president of Apple's iPod division, which oversaw the development of the iPod and iPhone. He served as a special advisor to Steve Jobs until late 2009. Tony previously worked as the chief technology officer at Philips. He is a graduate of the University of Michigan. Welcome.
Thanks, Jessica.
Tony, you grew up going to 12 schools, is that right?
Yeah, I went to 12 schools over 15 years.
Why did your family move around so much?
Well, my dad was in sales at Levi Strauss, the jeans company, and we would move wherever the company wanted him to start new business, new sales, or primp up sales in those areas.
Was there any sense that you might want to do the same?
And my dad would always encourage me. He was like, I love it. He loves his job. He loves the relationships with the people that he worked with. But at the end of the day, he would say, use your mind. Use your mind. Don't use your hands. Use your mind. Mm-hmm. And luckily, you know, where I am now, I'm using my mind and my hands.
From an early age, you had encounters with technology and had a fascination with how things worked. What are your earliest memories of that?
Well, I think my first memory of just, you know, kind of building things and understanding things was through my grandfather. My grandfather would put me in harm's way, so to speak, when I was 4 or 5 and say, hey, change this electrical switch. Let's build a birdhouse. And then ultimately, when we would move away from him, then I would go and take apart old tube televisions and various other products around the house just to see how they worked. I didn't know much, but I was just curious, you know, take it apart, see what's going on.
You mentioned your grandfather. Is this your paternal grandfather?
Yeah, my mother's father.
Half your family is from Eastern Europe. Your paternal side is from Lebanon.
Yes.
What influence did Lebanon or Russia have in your upbringing, if any?
Well, food, number one, right? Mm-hmm. So we would have pierogi on one day, and the next day we would have, tabbouleh, and it would go back and forth. So holidays were very mixed, both Christian background families. But both families were fully Americanized at that point. But there were still, you know, those great aunts and uncles that would come and tell the old stories. And, you know, you would have Russian being spoken or Arabic being spoken. Unfortunately, I didn't learn any of those languages. But it was just a nice influence.
Given that you came from an immigrant family, was there any sense of like just having to hustle and be entrepreneurial at all or pioneering?
For me, I always saw my grandfather working. I saw my mother working, my father working all the time. And so that was just a normal thing. You know, when we would, on the weekends, we would be cutting the lawns together, right? We would be building something. We'd be repairing something. You were always doing something, fixing a window.
When was your first encounter with computers or with the technological world?
I think this was in 1979. Mm-hmm. I took a first summer school course. I didn't know what these computers were, but I said, I'm going to take some computer class. And it turned out to be an IBM 360 mainframe somewhere far away in a paper terminal. And I just started using paper punch cards and doing basic programming. But also my father being in sales and he was like an early telecommuter. Levi's adopted a lot of technology very, very early for the salesmen, these remote salesmen. And so he would actually have these terminals that you would put your telephone on top of, and you would type things to place orders and things. And so I got this kind of sense that things are coming.
So your first computer was an Apple II when you were 12 years old. Do you remember how much it was?
Oh, absolutely, because actually, this is the case where my grandfather doubled whatever I made that summer to help me buy a computer. He didn't know what it was, but because he was a carpenter and also a superintendent, he knew tools were very, very important to do the next thing. So he saw this as a tool, and he's like, I don't know what it is, but you really want it, so I'm going to go halvesies with you, but you just have to earn all that other money. So I worked incredibly hard that summer. He matched it, and I got the Apple II. I think it was about $2,700. That was a lot of money back in those days.
What did you do with it?
really, for me, I started programming because that was actually a culture. You know, you might know of Make Magazine today. Make Magazine, you open it up and you can do all these different hacker-like things. Well, back then, there was Apple Insider and there's some different other magazines like that, Insight Magazine. And they actually had programs in there so that you could learn from those programs. I would type them into the computer and see what they did and dissect them. And so I was able to literally learn to teach myself programming through those magazines and books.
You were an avid self-starting learner, it seems. How were you as a student in school?
I was very good at the things I was interested in. And the other things that bored me, you know, I was not necessarily a great student. I only did things that I was very curious in. And so in the case of computer class, because I had already done computers, I went to computer class. And literally in that class, I would try to teach the class. And obviously, that was much the chagrin of the teacher. And at the end of each of those classes, I was almost thrown out every single time. So, you know, it's let's put it this way. I was not very contained.
Another interest of yours was music growing up.
Growing up in Detroit, yes.
What kind of music and where did that start?
Well, I think it first started when I was young, probably in second or third grade. We had next-door neighbors in Rochester, New York. And those neighbors were in junior high and high school. And I don't know why they wanted to hang out with us, but they did. And I would listen to, you know, bands like Led Zeppelin and Aerosmith back when they were really in the day. And I was like, these are wonderful. And from that, I just started learning about music. My family was really not musical, but my brother and I, we just awoke to that.
You've worked as a DJ from time to time.
Yeah, nothing like you would think of a DJ today. Mm-hmm. But I'd literally take my music out and people would go, oh, I like that. Could you play for this party? Could you play for that party? And so I just got to getting bigger and bigger events and doing different things for friends. And it was just a hobby for me.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tony Fadell, co-founder of Nest Labs, a company that makes smart digital assistants for the home or office. Tony previously worked at Apple, where he oversaw 18 versions of the iPod and 3 versions of the iPhone. He served as a special assistant to Steve Jobs until late 2009. You graduated from the University of Michigan, and your first job was at a company called General Magic, which was a spinoff of Apple.
Yes, right. Absolutely. There were a few people who left Apple to create, and Apple was one of the first investors in General Magic. But the founding team were the initial engineers and marketers that did the Macintosh in 1982, 83, 84. So I wanted to go and work with my heroes, the people who really knew how to build computers and the things that I loved. I wanted to go learn from them.
And when you left there to join Philips, you had plans for a new generation of hardware devices. How seminal was General Magic in your own development?
Well, it was amazing on many different levels. Number one, on engineering and just learning how to engineer and design products from the best minds in the time. So we got to do that. And then I also learned about partnering and how to try to work with companies all around the world. And I was only 21, 22 at the time, so I got to learn about how to work with these different companies to try to build a technology platform. Then also with marketers like Joanna Hoffman and people like that who could then tell the message out to consumers and see if we could get them to buy. So I also learned what not to do.
Which
because
was?
General Magic was a huge flame out. It tanked. We probably sold, I think, maybe 10,000 devices for a company that had almost $500 million invested in 1992, 93 timeframe. But remember, at General Magic, what we were doing, we were creating what was a precursor to the iPhone, just 20 years ahead of its time.
So was the fact that you were too early and that the market wasn't ready for it, was that the major contributor to the company's demise? Or what other factors were there?
I think, you know, there were too many features. There was too much technology, and there wasn't necessarily a market that could understand it yet because we were so far ahead. And then the internet occurred, right? All of these came together and it unraveled very quickly. And so we found a lot of our initial engineers and a lot of our team, they went off to be the founders of eBay. right, and Web TV, and all kinds of other incredible companies all around Silicon Valley. And in some cases, there one reporter said that General Magic was the greatest startup that had to die, right, so that we could, it could let all of these different flowers bloom.
While other colleagues were going to eBay and other startups, you went to Philips, which had more than 260,000 employees, and you started the mobile division within Philips. And at the time, you were 25 years old. Talk to me about that experience.
Sure, absolutely. So at General Magic, I saw this this amazing wealth of technology that was created over a span of 4 or 5 years. Kind of languishing. And I said, there's got to be some great things we can do with that technology. And I started creating my own product, what I thought we could use this technology for. And I took it to General Magic, and they said, you know, the die is cast. We have this roadmap. An interesting thing. Maybe we'll do it one day. Mm-hmm. And that frustrated me because I could see we were not heading down the right path. And specifically, I reached out to Philips Electronics through my contacts there. And they got me a meeting with the CEO of Philips and I pitched him this product.
What was the product at the
time?
The
product ultimately turned out to be one of the very first Windows CE devices. It was called the Philips Velo, and it was what we call like a billfold like product that had a little keyboard and a little display and a modem, so that you could do emails from wherever you were and take notes and do spreadsheets. It was a very critically acclaimed product, one of the best of its kind at that point, and that was born out of my time at General Magic. And I was just lucky enough at that age to learn about how to build that kind of product and build a team. And learn how to be actually a true leader inside of a large company.
And speaking of leadership, it wasn't uncomplicated. You would say that when you would get excited, you would get loud. What exactly, what did you mean?
Well, you know, I'm naturally an animated character. And so when I was passionate about something, I would raise my voice. I would start flailing my arms. And I would like, we have to do this. You understand? And so it was this... sometimes it was called youthful overexuberance, and because I just really wanted these things to happen, and when I grew into a leader, it took some time. I learned that my voice and the way I carried myself would amplify, and I learned that kind of thing wasn't so great, you know, because you needed to be a rock steady leader all the time. I think for the leadership role I was given, I had to grow into those shoes, and it was, and I grew as fast as I could. There was one funny thing, which was the team. They hung a big siren and flashing light above my desk, and whenever I was in the office, they would turn on, flip on the siren, and say, "Tony's in the office," and so everyone knew, like, oh, "Tony's here, watch out." But it was all in jest. It was a lot of fun.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tony Fadell, co-founder of Nest Labs. We'll hear more from Tony coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Tony Fadell, co-founder of Nest Labs, which makes the Nest Learning Thermostat. Prior to starting Nest, Tony spent 9 years at Apple, where he led the team that built the iPod and the iPhone. He was a special advisor to Steve Jobs until 2009. You finally left Philips, and you started your own company called Fuse in 1998.
That's correct.
What was the ambition for Fuse? What was the idea behind Fuse?
Well, I had seen this digital transition occurring in the home. We were looking at HDTV coming into the home. I had now experienced MP3s for the first time. And I thought, and MP3 is the digital audio file. And I thought, as the world becomes more and more digital inside the home, where are people going to buy these things? And so I was envisioning creating the Dell of consumer electronics, literally somewhere which you could go online in the internet to buy a home theater system that would be fully configured for you.
What was the response from companies and from venture capitalists?
It's a great question. So given my track record, I was able to pull in money from people who trusted that we knew what we were doing. And so we were aligned with Samsung at the time. We were I had a few other angel investors, and we got started. And we were doing really well in terms of defining the vision, but it was going to take another set of capital to really pull this off. The internet boom was happening. This was 99, right? No one wanted to do anything with hardware. They're like, hardware? This is crazy. You just want build a service, you know, an internet service, cheap, easy, 10 people. Don't waste your time with this. And I said, no, I think this is really important. And then the internet bubble happened and it burst. And we ended up not having any chance to get any money, regardless of whether we were an electron company or an atom company. And so we were languishing.
And what was going on in your own personal life at the time?
So personally, I was working day and night trying to get Fuse off the ground. I think I made 85 different VC pitches to try to raise the money.
Why not try to innovate this product also inside of Philips? What was the catalyst for leaving Philips?
I think the first one was is I just wanted my own company. I had learned a lot at Philips about we could build anything, but can a company actually sell it? At the end of the day, the people who were entrusted to sell and market it, they didn't understand the product. We had a tough time when we said we have a PDA. People were like, well, we don't have a place for PDAs in the store.
Right.
We don't know how to sell these things. Mm-hmm. And so Philips decided they'd rather sell TVs than our stuff.
You have a very acute engineering acumen, but you also seem to have overlaid that with a real business sense as well, which it seems unique to have both coexisting.
It was a learned skill. I think a lot of sales and marketing came from my dad and watching what my dad did at Levi. But then also, I saw the failure of General Magic. I also had my own startups along the way. And so it just developed over time, and I was able to use the technology as my way of the foot in the door because that would be my differentiation.
Incidentally, one of the companies you went to during this challenging period when Fuse wasn't getting off the ground was Real Networks, where you had a brief stint for about 6 weeks prior to going to Apple.
Yes.
And some say that your transition to Apple was a turning point in the digital music evolution to some degree. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. You know, it's undeniable that the iPod and iTunes and then the iTunes Music Store and then obviously became the iTunes Store has changed the music business, the video business, and movie business.
I guess my question is sort of the counterfactual. Had you stayed at Real Networks, would the evolution or revolution taken place, could it have taken place in Real Networks versus Apple?
I think that Apple has some very unique characteristics, being that it touches every part of the consumer experience, hardware, software, now retail. Real Networks was more of a technology company and more of a software company who was going to partner with hardware companies to get some of these things done. So I think that having the, as we call, whole widget thinking underneath one tent is incredibly important for the rapid evolution that happened that the iPod and iTunes brought to the marketplace.
Okay. So finally, you left Real Networks and you knocked on Apple's door.
They knocked on my door, actually.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
So while I was at Fuse and we were going through these difficult times, I decided I had to just clear my head for a little while, and I went skiing for a couple of days. And as I'm on a chairlift in Vail, I got a call from John Rubinstein, mm-hmm. who was the senior vice president of hardware at Apple. And he said, hey, we'd love you to talk to you. We'd think about you as a consultant to come and work on this new idea we have. And lo and behold, that ultimately, you know, 6 weeks later, I created the initial model and all the block diagrams and spreadsheets and all the things necessary to justify this product. Being the iPod that ultimately then, you know, 10 months later shipped to the world.
It's been said that you are the godfather of the iPod or the father of the iPod, or what would you call yourself? I know you're going to say it's a whole team of people, but what would you tell your kids?
I would say that I was a major force in making it a reality, but it took a team of people all around me to do so. But I was very passionate. I'm passionate about music. I was passionate and still am about portable products. And so it wasn't just and Apple wanted to get something new out. So it was the environment. It was the people. And it was myself really all driving ahead saying we need to make this happen.
So when you did get the call from John Rubinstein, where was Apple at that moment in terms of creating the iPod? Were they far along and saying, okay, we want a personal device for music, or is that where you came in?
So as it was described to me at the time was that iTunes had just shipped about 2 months earlier, and iTunes was a phenomenal music player, but it only worked on a Macintosh. And you could rip your CDs and play them back and create CDs on it. But they wanted to bring that music onto a Walkman-like product. So they said that was the frame. Now, what could you do given this context? Why don't you work with Jeff Robin and figure out what could be built?
There are so many versions about the early days of the iPod, and you know everything was behind such closed doors and behind these secret walls that Steve wanted to develop. Were you surprised by this level of secrecy that Steve created in the culture?
In some ways, no, I wasn't, because at General Magic, the culture was based on what they had done with the Mac, right? And so they had a super secret culture in the Mac. We had a super secret culture at General Magic. And so for me, that was just the only way you did business. So coming to Apple was, it didn't seem extreme to me. And it's still odd for partners and people to go, why do you do this? But at the end of the day, I believe it is the right way to get things done.
You mentioned that secrecy is pretty critical, but secrecy is not ironclad, and there's always a leak here and there.
Absolutely.
So what good is secrecy ultimately?
Secrecy, you know, it's hard to know what you can talk about on a project with your friends or with your spouse or with partners. And so if you have a total culture of openness, everything moves around and all of your competitors and everyone will ultimately know, because Silicon Valley is a small place, or a certain business environment is a small place because people leave companies and join others. And so you have to say, look, this is about a team. It's about our ideas. It's about something that we're creating that no one ever has seen before. We have to cherish this. This is ours. And when we're ready to tell as a team what we're doing, we can have the maximum impact. That's when we want to do it. And so Silicon Valley engineers understand that.
One of the reasons Steve Jobs was focused on secrecy was he was always worried that his key employees would be poached by other firms. Here you have Matt Rogers now working with you, a former Apple employee and other Apple employees. And you did promise Steve that you would not make any competing products with the iPod. How do you view your starting a new company with your colleagues from Apple?
Well, to me, there's two things. The first one being, this is a free country. And you can look at it as when these people join your team, they're only yours and you can treat them any way you want. Mm-hmm. And there's another one, which is they are free people. Mm-hmm. And they can choose at will to join any company they want. And it's based on what the company can do for them and what they can do for the company. And it's a give and take. So my belief, after seeing both sides of this, is that I like the freedom is king, and it's up to the company and its culture to continue to retain those people. We will pay you competitive rates, but not ungodly rates. We are going to make sure that you have one of the coolest products that you could possibly be working on. You know, this anti-poaching thing and all that other stuff. I just don't think that's the right thing to do.
You ultimately spent about 9 years at Apple, most of which was overseeing 18 versions of the iPod and a few versions of the iPhone. At what point did you start to get itchy feet? Like, okay, I'm starting to think that I'd like to move on to my next thing.
Well, doing 18 generations of iPods, a lot of iPods. But, you know, my wife also worked at Apple, and she worked for Steve. And so the two of us were really, really, on a treadmill, just working all the time. And ultimately, we had kids. We had two boys, and they were, you know, just born and 1 year old. And we were looking at each other and going, we're never going to be able to buy this time back. So let's go and focus on them focus on the family, and then we'll figure out what's next after that.
How long after you started working at Apple did you get married to Danielle Lampert, who is your wife?
Yes. So my wife and I met about a year after I started at Apple, and then we were married 8 months after we met.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the co-founder of Nest Labs, a company that makes smart digital assistants for the home and the office, including the Nest Thermostat, which is their first product that they launched to consumers in fall 2011. How did the idea for Nest originate?
Well, my wife and I, we love the Lake Tahoe area, and so we decided that we were going to build a green home in Lake Tahoe, hopefully the greenest home that we knew of, as well as the most connected home. And through the process of design, through the process of learning about all the products in the marketplace, we found deficiencies, or I found deficiencies all over the maintenance and usability of your home. And I was like, this is crazy. There's got to be better products.
What were some of those?
Obviously the thermostat was one. Mm-hmm. But another one was solar panels. And luckily, over the span of when we started the project to the time we had to really commit to the project, solar panels were revolutionized. But when we looked at the thermostat, it had not evolved at all in those 3 years of design. And so after I had left Apple, I found some time while, you know, I was thinking about what was next. And I was like, maybe I can design my own thermostat. And as I started to dig into the problem, I found out, wow, this simple thing is really hard to do. It's so hard, and especially to create one that would be for an iPod or an iPhone-like consumer. What is the next generation home going to look like when the interface to your home is always in your pocket or in your hand? That thermostat quickly turned into a smartphone in disguise. And so one day I went and said, honey, I think I know what I'm going to do next. I'm going to make a thermostat. And she goes, what? The iPod guy making a thermostat? I don't get it. And then after I explained about, you know, for 15 or 30 seconds about what the business looked like, she's like, you'd be crazy not to do it.
What is so innovative and special about the Nest thermostat?
If you look at the Nest, it's a hockey puck. It's about the size of a hockey puck with high-quality materials. And so when you look at it, you're like, whoa, Toto, we're not in Kansas anymore. It's something totally different. And it's really simple to use. And so we went around that user-focused design and included not just a beautiful product, but also one that learns. Before the Nest existed, the 250 million thermostats that are in the U.S. installed, less than 10% of them were programmed to save any energy at all. Now with Nest, because we have a learning algorithm that basically when you get up in the morning, you might set it to one temperature, you go to work, you set it to another, come back, another temperature. And when you go to bed, you set it to a temperature. We watch those patterns, and then we just play those back for you. And 99% of all of our Nest thermostats have learned a schedule or programmed a schedule to save energy. Mm-hmm. We also have auto away built in. So we sense motion in the home. And when we don't see motion for a period of time during waking hours, we actually then turn down the temperature to something that you specify to say, I'm not here, save me energy.
Where did the name Nest come from?
back in the 90s, there was a show called MTV Cribs. You know, it was all about your house. And so I kind of riffed off of that with my friends. I would say, hey, come on back to my nest. Come back to my nest. Let's go listen to some music, have some food, what have you. And so that stuck.
You mentioned Matt Rogers, who's your co-founder, who actually started off as your intern at Apple.
That's right.
You brought him on board. And he said, you know, at some point he was kind of done with making toys for people, referring to the iPod. How much of your motivation for starting this Nest Labs and the thermostat is you're wanting to do something that's more socially minded outside of, you know, making toys?
Well, Matt, actually, I'll have to be very honest, is Matt kept bugging me that we should do this project because I was like, I don't know, I'm not ready for a startup right now. I have kids and everything. And he was like, no, we must do this. So he was as driving a force, and that's why he's a co-founder, to make this happen. But once you have kids, to your question, you start looking at the world very differently. And when it was very simple to say, here's an unloved space, a thermostat space, tons of innovation can be brought to it. And by the way, ton of innovation that I know how to build. And by the way, we can save a lot of energy. How could I not do this?
So, again, you approached venture capitalists like in your Fuse days, but life has changed a little bit having developed the iPod. I assume raising capital was a piece of cake this time.
Yeah, it was a much, much different experience. It was more like, Tony, we know you're doing something. Let us give you money.
Right.
We did a great job. We have to do the right thing for our investors and prove that we have a business case. Mm-hmm. But we were able to basically get our money on a handshake.
What has been harder for you than you thought in the early days of Nest?
What's been harder? Well, I thought that there was going to be much more expertise in the heating and cooling business that we could draw upon. I knew it was going to be hairy and kind of scary to try to hook up to these 20 and 30-year-old systems, because who knows what's out there? It's not like it's a typical USB port or some kind of standard that's out there. It's very, very wild and woolly. And so what we had to do is we went into 500 homes and looked at all of the different wiring combinations and built a team of industry experts, installers, mm-hmm. who know how this stuff works from around the country to help us design the product.
Incidentally, could you tell me a little bit about the time you spent between Apple and Nest traveling?
Sure, absolutely. We decided we were going to travel the world with the kids, and we lived in Paris for 6 months and put our oldest son, into French public preschool. While we were living in Paris, we were literally a block away from the Louvre. Every time I'd go, I'd get inspired, I'd learn about more artists, and I saw that they had different periods of their life, you know, Picasso's green period, Picasso's blue period, what have you. And they took some time off and they went and re-energized themselves and did something different. And so I was looking at it, mapping it onto my own life, going, what am I going to do next? And this is where, you know, I'm sitting on a bridge and I'm looking at the Louvre and I'm thinking of this thermostat idea. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know if I'm ever going to have a better idea. Let's make this happen. That's when I called up Matt. We moved on from there.
Did you become uber focused on, well, what thermostats did they have at the Louvre when you were walking around?
Once you tune into a device that you've ignored for years and years and years, now you start looking. I see one here and I see one there. It just shakes me every time and I go, yes, ours is better. You see that light, the world in a whole new set of eyes.
It's like when you become pregnant, all of a sudden everybody around you is pregnant.
Exactly. I never saw kids before until I have kids.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica.
My guest has been Tony Fadell.
Coming up, we'll meet Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Reed. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Reed, an organization that promotes literacy in India. Planet Reed adds subtitling to songs on TV programs in the same language as the audio, so people can read the words as they are sung. Same language subtitling, or SLS, first appeared in 1999 in the Indian state of Gujarat on a 30-minute program of film songs. And now the service is available to 300 million viewers on a weekly basis. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to start off with your personal history. You grew up in a town on the southern eastern coast of India called Pondicherry. There's an ashram in the center of the town. What role did the ashram play in your life?
Typically, when you think of an ashram in India, you think of people meditating, doing yoga, on a totally spiritual journey. But the Aurobindo Ashram is also very unusual in the sense that actually it emphasizes a lot of sports. So physical education is very important. The other interesting thing about the Aurobindo Ashram was that there are no exams in the schools. So I went from kindergarten till college in one sweep without ever having taken a single exam.
How is your knowledge tested without an exam?
So the system there is that the classes are extremely small. So you might have about 5 to 10 students typically in a classroom. And the teacher is able to really look at the progress of each individual student quite personally.
So after graduating from the ashram, you go to the Indian Institute of Technology to get a master's in physics. Do you remember taking your first test?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I have to admit that for the first semester, it was really a struggle for me, switching from never having taken an exam to probably the other extreme of competition in India. In fact, the whole first semester was very difficult.
And then you find yourself in Ithaca, New York, of all places. You left India and went to Cornell to study communications. Do you remember your first impressions of the United States?
I do. I remember just being chaperoned by my fellow student, and he took me sort of around campus, showing things around. Everything was fascinating. But what really caught my attention was that he took me down to the basement of his chemistry department and showed me this box and a machine. And he took out some coins, put it in this machine, and then pressed a button, and down came a can of Coke. And I remember that was so fascinating to me that actually you could get a can of Coke just by, I mean, not even talking to a person.
And do you remember the feeling of cold in Ithaca? I mean, you grew up in Pondicherry where it's like 100 degrees Fahrenheit. What was it like to feel Ithaca winters?
I remember the first time I saw snow. In fact, I was 23 years old and it snowed and we were all in a classroom. And all of the Indian students left the room, literally, and the professor was wondering what's going on. Mm. And then I also remember when it was really cold, actually I had already started to sport a beard, so my breath would actually freeze on the beard, and it was like icicles on the beard. So I remember that as well.
My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. By adding words to the bottom of a TV screen in the same language as the audio, adults and children can practice their reading skills. Bridge, the first time you began to focus on literary issues was, ironically, not in India, but in Ecuador while you were a student at Cornell. How did you first come into contact with those literacy issues in Ecuador?
The project that I did in Ecuador was to actually document the knowledge of medicinal plants of 7 indigenous communities there in the Andes. The issue that we were really concerned was that people were losing their knowledge. The issue of literacy came to the fore then because we realized that even after documenting the knowledge in a written form, it was still not accessible to most people in those communities. So we decided that we would actually represent that written text of the book that we ended up publishing in an iconic form. So every plant remedy and how it was actually used was represented visually. Mm-hmm. And when we did that, we found out that even children were able to make, sense of what we had put down in print.
Incidentally, you were trying to prevent the disappearance of this knowledge of medicinal plants. Was there any resonance for you because you had studied Ayurvedic medicine at all when you were in India?
Yes, my family in particular is extremely oriented towards Ayurveda and natural remedies. My dad actually eats aloe vera, and he's convinced me to eat aloe vera. And so there are so many things that I just grew up doing at home that were mostly, in the naturopathic realm. So that definitely had an influence. But I think what really influenced me to take this conservation of knowledge issue in Ecuador was really the politics of knowledge, because a lot of knowledge is actually extracted from indigenous communities, and that ends up being somewhere else and some other people benefit from it. So our goal was that how can we conserve the knowledge for the people and with the people?
And then how did this interest in knowledge and literacy translate to this idea for same language subtitling, or SLS?
So I spent about 2 years in Ecuador doing this conservation of knowledge, and then I went back to Ithaca to write my dissertation. And typically what you do when you write your dissertation is actually you watch movies to just, procrastinate, really. And so we were 5 or 6 of us just sitting in a room watching Spanish films. And this one in particular happened to be Pedro Almodovar's The Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, hilarious movie. And we were watching this film, and it was in the subtitles were in English. So So the audio was in Spanish. And at that, I just made a casual comment that why don't they just put Spanish subtitles on a Spanish film? And that way we would be able to learn Spanish more. And that's what, that was our goal at that moment. And actually, if they just put Hindi subtitles on Bollywood film songs, maybe India would become literate. And it was more like a casual comment. I said, well, let me try it out as a research project. And that's how the whole thing started.
It's ironic that you had to be in Ecuador in order to come up with this idea. I guess you're feeling illiterate and you're feeling the need to learn Spanish caused the issue to become more personal in a way.
Right. I totally agree with that. Actually, my interest in learning Spanish had become very, very strong. In fact, to a point where I was a little bit insane, perhaps, to actually label everything at home in Spanish. So everybody, my roommates, were like a little irritated that whenever they picked up a knife, it said cuchillo on it. So,
by the way, you grew up in a very literate, well-educated family, but in India, 35% of the population is considered illiterate. So what was your exposure to illiteracy in India when you were growing up?
My mom actually became literate much later in life as an adult. And so I could see shades of literacy even within my family. My dad was totally literate. My mom was semi-literate. Illiteracy was all around us in a way. So there was always this sense that illiteracy is a major issue in India.
And when we say the literacy rate is, we should translate to 65%, how is literacy measured? Is that 65% accurate?
It's not a very accurate measure. What typically they do is a census operator actually shows up to a home in a village and would ask a family to list down all the names and then mark each person on whether they're literate or not based on what one individual in the household actually says. So you end up with people who have, let's say, learned a little bit of the alphabet or learned to basically draw their name, not even write their name, just draw their name. They will call themselves literate. Half the people who are thought of as literate by the census are actually what I would call semi-literate.
My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through a service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. By adding words to the bottom of a TV screen in the same language as the audio, adults and children can practice their reading skills. So you came back to India in 1996, where you pursue this SLS idea further, this same language subtitling idea further. How did you get it off the ground initially?
What we would do is, take some, tapes of Bollywood film songs and show them at bus stops, in railway stations, in villages, slums. And what we would do is we'd just plop two televisions, one playing the songs without the subtitles and one playing with the same language subtitles. And we'd ask people to just compare the two and see which one they liked. Almost everybody, over, I would say, 90% or 95% of the people we interviewed, actually said that they preferred the songs with the subtitles. So what's happening is that people are getting their reading skills practiced as the words get highlighted, and they really don't know that very consciously. They're not aware of it.
Now, you talk about Bollywood films. For those of us in New York or Washington, D.C. or Texas, we might not have had exposure to Bollywood films. What is a Bollywood film?
Oh, if you haven't seen one, please make it a life ambition to see one. I'm a really passionate Bollywood fan myself. Typically, a Bollywood film will have six songs on average, which would mean that they're really musicals. So it's an industry that has just captivated a large section of the world, I would say, not just in India.
Now, when you talk about just plopping these TVs down in railway stations or bus stops, that seems a little strange to me. I think of Grand Central Station in New York. If you just plop a TV down in the middle of the lobby, people would just run away from it, probably. What is the mindset? Are there people just hanging out around the railway stations just watching this stuff?
I think India, in any place, you could actually create a theater and there would be people just congregating there. Any small incident will get a crowd. And we'd get easily 100 to 200 people just gather around the television set. So there was just that, I mean, people have a lot of time on their hands too. And they're waiting for a train or they're getting off a train. It's not like they have to, you know, rush off to some meeting or work. You know, pace of life is quite slow for most people.
So you have this casual focus group among these people in the railway stations and the bus stops and the villages. How do you then get it on TV? Your first SLS program was on Gujarat State TV, which is Gujarat is one of the states in India. How did that happen?
So after we were convinced that people in the villages liked this idea, we actually did a proper controlled experiment in a low-income school. And we found that the children in grades 3, 4, and 5 who were exposed to the subtitles, their reading improvement was much faster than the group that was not exposed to the songs with the subtitles. Now, based on that study, we thought, now we have the proof. And when we engaged the director at that point of the television station then, he flatly refused. And his hunch was that this, when you add the subtitles to a song-based program, it'll ruin the program. And so it really became his gut feeling versus our data.
How did you get over that?
What we did is we wrote to all the station directors around the country and asked them if they would try this out on any program. And we would pay for the subtitling, but would they just be willing to allow us to try this out? And nobody responded, except one person who happened to be the director of the All India Radio in Gujarat. And unfortunately, he was not the director of the television station. But 3 months later, this guy who wrote back actually ended up becoming the director of the television station in Gujarat State, a total stroke of luck. And he basically said, try this out on television for 3 episodes only. And if the response is good, we'll see. He got calls from a lot of people saying that, wow, you guys are doing wonderful work for literacy.
My guest is Brij Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through a karaoke-like service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. How did you fund the project throughout this time?
So we've tapped into a lot of various sources, and we've kind of had a lot of patchwork funding. But then we really got a big break in 2002. We applied to Development Marketplace. It's a global innovation competition at the World Bank with this idea. And we basically asked for the maximum that they would give, which was about $250,000. And to our surprise, actually, we got it. And that really gave us the huge break that we needed to then try and approach national television in Delhi. Of course, even after that, we faced other kinds of hurdles. And I mean, this project has been going on for 11 years now, mm-hmm. and there have been so many hurdles. So for example, there was this ridiculous hurdle, I would say, where one of the directors in the national television program wanted actually our equipment, which was about $50,000, $60,000 of editing equipment. He wanted that in exchange for allowing us to subtitle even though they were not paying for the equipment. But even then, we told those guys that, okay, you can have the equipment, provided you promise that you're going to continue subtitling on a national television program for 5 years. And they couldn't accept that.
Wow, so you almost succumbed to his ridiculous request.
Yeah, actually, it was a kind of a pretty thought-through succumbing, if I can call it that, because what we knew was the life of the equipment is really about 5 years.
In addition to other challenges you faced, you were having difficulty getting FaceTime with the CEO of TV in India, which is kind of analogous to, I guess, the head of the FCC in the United States. How did you get his attention ultimately?
Getting to this person was not easy. So I sent in word that I really wanted to meet him, and he sort of said that he might be able to see me, but wasn't really sure. So I waited about 5-6 hours literally outside as I saw one executive after another just walk by me, and I couldn't get any time with him, but he kind of knew that I was waiting. So finally he sent word that if I wouldn't mind just taking a ride with him in his car as he went from the television station to his hotel. That was about a 10-minute ride. So I said, great, And then I got into the car with him. I already had my laptop running a Bollywood film song, just turned up the volume and showed it to him. And you won't believe it. He just looked at the idea for literally 15 seconds, didn't say a word, and then said, okay, you come and see me in Delhi, because I think we could actually do something with this. And he became one of the strongest supporters of this idea.
Do you worry that there might be some pushback that maybe consumers or viewers want the choice to have these words on the bottom of their screen?
What we did in India is actually did like 3-4 surveys to first find out whether even the literate people actually like this idea or not. And what we found is that the popularity among the literate was over 90%. It was just the entertainment and the karaoke effect of subtitling. On the semi-literate, it was both entertainment and reading practice that they valued. And the illiterates also valued, and their support was about 70%. So people were willing to support it pretty much all across.
Now, Bridge, you live in the San Francisco area in Oakland, yet this project is India-based. How do you split your time?
I pretty much spend half the year in India and half the year in the Bay Area in Oakland. What I focus on is policy pushing in India and also fundraising and relationship building in the United States.
How many children do you have?
I have 3 children, 2 boys and a girl.
What languages do they speak?
Our children are growing up speaking Hindi, English, of course, and then Portuguese.
Why Portuguese?
So my wife speaks Portuguese, and I speak Spanish. And I wanted Spanish, she wanted Portuguese, she won, of course.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.